Running a business is no cakewalk, but with SAP Concur Solutions, you can be ready for anything. You can manage travel, expenses, and AP all on one platform that's packed with AI and best practices, and that delivers it all through an easy, clear, I can't believe how simple that is experience. So, while not much can be done about that guy who never fails to burn the microwave popcorn and stink up the entire office, with SAP Concur, you can easily handle almost anything else. Take control of your business finances today at concur.com. That's concur.com. Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
Now, your ideas don't have to wait. Now, they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business, and evolving your passions. They push what technology can do, so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to Now.
It's brand new season two. I'm Marissa Thalberg.
And I'm Stephen Wolf Bedeta. And we're excited to be back having bigger, bolder, and always real conversations.
Straight from the C-suite front lines of marketing, media, and more.
We have great friends joining from people you may know, like Wilmer Valderrama and Bobby Burke.
And people you'll want to know. So grab a coffee or, hey, even an Aperol Spritz and come join us on America's number one podcast network, iHeart.
Listen to brand new on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Brought to you by the reinvented 2012 Camry. It's ready. Are you?
Hey there, Tech Stuff listeners. This is Jonathan Strickland, and I've got a request for all of you. Now, Chris and I have decided that we're going to try an experiment. We're doing our first crowdsourced episode of Tech Stuff, and we want to know what your pick is for the worst video game of all time. Now, nominations, you can make one nomination. You nominate one game and you need to tell us the name of the game and the platform it was on. And it could be any platform. It could be an arcade game. It could be a PC, Mac, Xbox, PS3, Nintendo, handheld console. It can be web-based if you like. But just you let us know what the platform is so we can make sure we count that as the votes. So you can nominate your game either through email, which is techstuff@howstuffworks.com, or you can nominate through Twitter or Facebook. And we're going to put a cutoff date on this. I want to have the episode go up by the end of September of 2011. So let's say you need to get your nominations in by September 8th, 2011. So if you get those nominations into us, we will make sure we include those in the process, and we will have an episode where we give you the worst video games of all time based upon the votes of our listeners. Thanks a lot. Can't wait to hear from you.
Get in touch with technology with Tech Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hello again, everyone. Welcome to Tech Stuff. My name is Chris Paulette, and I'm an editor at HowStuffWorks.com. Sitting across from me, as usual, is senior writer Jonathan Strickland.
Butterfly in the sky, I can go twice as high.
Nice.
Thank you.
You know, originally we were talking about the possibility of doing an ebooks podcast, and then we realized we've done an ebooks podcast, but we really haven't talked about a lot of the developments in publishing since then.
That's right. And we had some listeners on Google Plus. So here's a little note from Google Plus. And John and Paul, very biblical fellows, I suppose, gave us
very Beatle fellows.
Or very Beatle fellows, perhaps so. But both John and Paul had asked that we talk about ebooks and e-publishing. John was very insistent. By the way, John, we do have an episode on e-books, which I had completely forgotten about. I believe Chris did as well. And yep. This morning, as I was looking at my notes, I realized, wait a minute, this sounds really familiar. And sure enough, we have done one. But yeah, we wanted to talk about sort of the back end, not from a technological perspective so much as from sort of a business perspective, about publishing, what publishers do, and how that's starting to change in the ebook era.
Yeah.
So I guess first we should just start talking about what publishers do.
Okay. Yeah, that's actually a good question, especially because a lot of the discussions I've read recently, and when I say recently, I would guess probably, I think I'm thinking about probably the last year, because ebooks have become a lot more popular.
Oh, yeah.
You see news reports from Amazon that they are outselling paperbacks now.
Yeah, I think it was like for every 100 paperbacks Amazon sold, they'd sell 115 ebooks. So it's already matched and outpaced the dead tree version of books.
Yep. But the thing is, in a lot of cases, the electronic version of the book costs close to, if not as much as, or in some cases more than, the price of a paper book, or P-book, as I like to call them.
Mm-hmm.
And people go, what the heck is going on here? If this is just bits and bytes, it doesn't take up any floor space, you don't have to design a special cover for it. You know, what are the publishers doing? What is the point of this?
Yeah.
And then you have to realize that they actually do quite a bit.
Yeah. So let's look at it from let's take electronic publishing out of the picture right now
and just talk about
publishers and what they do.
Okay.
From a traditional standpoint. So traditionally what a publisher would do is you have your authors. These are the people who are creating work, right?
Mm-hmm.
Then you've got editors who are editing the work, making sure it's worthy of publication.
Right.
Now, the publisher is the entity that takes that work and produces it in a mass production kind of way. And then so they're into production, they're into distribution in that they find buyers that buy up several units of books all at once.
Mm-hmm.
So bookstores really is what we're talking about here.
Right.
Publishers look for bookstores, outlets to sell these. So the publisher's customers are really bookstores. They're not really readers. Like you and I aren't a typical customer of a publisher.
Right.
But rather a Barnes & Noble, or until recently, a Borders would be a customer of a publisher.
Right.
So the publisher's job is to create, to produce the physical copies of this work, to send it to the various, or actually sell it to the various bookstores out there, vendors out there. For a price that's usually about half of what the list price is for the book.
Although your mileage may vary. It's going to depend on a lot of conditions.
Yeah. So let's say like the price that's actually on the cover of the book,
mm-hmm.
we're oversimplifying here, but in general, the wholesale price that the publisher sells to the bookstore is about 50% of that. And then a certain percentage of that goes to overhead. Some of it goes to covering the cost of paying the advance to the author. And also you have to keep in mind that bookstores don't sell every single copy of every book.
Right.
So occasionally bookstores have to send back copies of books they don't sell to the publisher in order to make up room for new books.
Right.
So that means that not everything the publisher sends out is actually going to get sold. Some of it's going to come back. So there are a lot of costs here. And also a publisher's other job is to market the authors, to get the word out about authors and to drive up interest about authors. So that's one of the things publishers theoretically will do for the people who write for them.
Yeah. In that way, I would say, when you said a few minutes ago that the reader is not the end customer of the publisher, I would say that's mostly the case. But in some ways, I mean, it is their responsibility to do a lot of the marketing work. And so, you know, they are in touch with the reader, and they do that as a small portion of that. But
yeah.
and they're really trying to help the bookstore sell books so that both the bookstore and the publisher win out.
And you can buy books. You can buy books directly from the publisher, but in general, that tends to be a very small number of sales compared to book sales through stores.
Yeah.
And so you also have another responsibility of publishers, which is kind of interesting. And this is an important one that is going to be have a pretty big impact with the electronic publishing era as well.
Mm-hmm.
And that is that publishers are responsible for finding new talent.
Right.
It's kind of like the music industry. When you think of like a music label going out and going to local venues and scouting out bands and saying, you know, this band actually has some promise, and they might not make it big for an album or two, but I really see something in them.
Mm-hmm.
Publishers do the same thing with authors. Now, when an author writes a book, the author generally gets an advance on that book, and that advance is a royalties advance. It's actually counted against whatever royalties that author would make through book sales.
Mm-hmm.
Well, a lot of authors, especially first-time authors, will not make that money back through book sales. They just aren't well known enough, so they won't get enough books sold to pay off that advance. So a lot of publishers are essentially paying authors at a loss, lots of new authors at a loss. But they're doing it by betting is that some of those authors are going to make it to the big time.
Mm-hmm.
And those authors are going to sell lots and lots and lots of books, and that will help offset the cost of paying all these other low-level authors who may not go anywhere that advance. So in a way, publishers are responsible for encouraging and sustaining authors who are trying to really make it in the publishing world and trying to actually become published authors.
Mm-hmm.
Without them, then you would have, you know, you wouldn't have that incentive really for authors to try and create. So when you think about things like, oh, well, Stephen King, man, he gets so much money for a book. You know, you could have some envy there. Perhaps you might question whether or not the work he does is worth the amount of money he makes. But at the same time, because Stephen King novels sell so well, that's part of what funds the publisher to encourage other authors to write.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a really big ecosystem, and it's actually pretty complex. I mean, the actual complexity of how much money comes back to the publisher and where that money goes is probably too complex for the purposes of this podcast. But I thought that it was important that we talk about that, and then we talk about how e-publishing is kind of shaking things up a bit,
mm-hmm.
or more than a bit in some cases.
Well, you talked about the music industry and how things have changed significantly, how the music industry has been nervous because, you know, on the one hand, they're concerned about things like piracy.
Yeah.
But they're also concerned because people are able to create their own home studios and record their own music and post it for sale on their own website because they don't have to worry about the costs of pressing CDs or vinyl anymore, although a lot of them do.
Yeah.
You know, the distribution is, you know, less of an issue now because, you know, once the marketing has gone out online, rather than having to put up posters in stores and do, you know, different events and things like that, you know, those are important, but a lot of bands can do a lot of that work themselves.
Right.
And so, you know, this has already been going on in the music industry, but, you know, this hasn't been so much of an issue for publishers until just recently.
Right, right.
You know, and I don't think we even touched on this when we talked about e-readers before. I don't even think about the e-books world going back that far, but it does go back to around 1971, when Michael Hart started Project Gutenberg. And, you know, the first person who got an ISBN, that's an international standard book number. It's a unique number assigned to every book, was Kim Blagg, around 1998. So some people have been publishing electronically for a while. I mean, Random House and HarperCollins, who are two big regular publishers, P and E.
Yeah.
You know, they were starting to sell digital in 2002. And that was all before the Kindle hit in 2007.
Well, yeah. And if you think about it, you know, there are a lot of computers you would buy that would come with an Encarta CD.
Yeah.
Well, that's a digital encyclopedia.
Yes.
You know, that's, you know, just because it comes on a solid form of medium, media rather, that doesn't mean that it's not digital. It is digital. It's just that it's digital stored on a disk.
Mm-hmm. Well, the e-publishing world is starting to shake up now. I mean, it's no secret that publishing has been having problems in the last few years anyway, especially with the economic downturn.
Yeah.
I've read that the closing of Borders stores here in the United States, that's going to create problems for traditional publishing too, because they can no longer count on the sales to come from the store. It's if you're unfamiliar with the situation here, Barnes & Noble and Borders and, you know, some of the other major public booksellers like Books A Million,
yep,
basically were credited with, I hate to say credited with, the closing of a lot of local bookshops,
right,
across the United States over the past, what would you say, probably 20 years or so?
Yeah, I think something like the, I had the number in front of me at one point, but it was, you know, the number of independent little bookstores had decreased dramatically, like by more than 50%, because partially at least, due to these big bookstores that could just take away their business.
Yeah. I mean, there are some that are big enough, people like Powell's in Portland, Oregon, and the Strand up in the New York City area, that are big enough to hold their own. But a lot of the smaller stores had dropped out of the picture there for a while.
And yeah, I've got the number now.
Mm-hmm.
So according to an article in The New Yorker, actually, the American Booksellers Association said the number of independent booksellers declined from 3,250 to 1,400 since 1999.
Okay, then.
So that's, you know, more than 50%.
And I read an article about the closing of Borders that said that publishers are going to have to cut their print runs because they no longer have Borders stores to help them distribute their books to readers.
Right.
And that's causing more turmoil. And now, with the popularity of e-readers surging and the ability of people to do things to publish on their own, this is going to cause things to shake up even further. And Lion, the new version of the Apple operating system, some of you have written in that you want a podcast on it. We need to talk about the possibility of doing that and possibly Windows 8. But mm-hmm. Lion offers people the ability to publish EPUB documents on, you know, from different Lion documents. So, you know, it's built into the operating system. I wouldn't be surprised to see that coming to other operating systems too in the future, which just makes it that much easier to publish your own ebooks.
Yeah, which can create another problem that we'll get into in a little bit. But before we do that, I wanted to talk a little more about some of the other problems that the publishing industry faces, which is that you've got some major companies that have not traditionally been publishers getting into the publishing game.
That's true.
And one of the biggest is Amazon.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, Amazon and e-readers, those two terms go very well together because we are all familiar with the Amazon Kindle, which revolutionized the electronic publishing industry.
Yeah, there were a couple ebook readers before. I first became acquainted with the Rocket ebook and Softbook back mm-hmm. around 1998.
Mm-hmm.
But they were really expensive and there just weren't a lot of books at the time.
Right. Amazon's plan was to create this electronic book reader, and also the company was incredibly intelligent in that they created apps for various other platforms that could also read the electronic book format that the Kindle uses.
Mm-hmm.
That's another thing to point out is that we don't have a single standard for electronic books.
That's correct.
There are several different electronic book formats out in the wild, and one of the really popular ones is the Kindle format.
Yes. .azw.
And I think a lot of people like that format simply because since they have apps on various other platforms and they can read it on a computer, they can read it on a smartphone, they can read it on their Kindle. That sort of utility is a very high selling point. Although some other companies like Apple have done a lot to try and undermine that in some ways with their own policies. We'll get into that as well because that also mm-hmm. plays a role in publishing.
Yeah.
So what makes publishers a little nervous, or really a little nervous is being kind, really scared of Amazon. One of the things was that Amazon for a while was really adamant about dictating what the price was going to be for an electronic book.
Mm-hmm.
And Amazon's decision was that it was going to be $9.99 for a new release, which publishers were not thrilled about. They did not like the idea of a vendor being able to say that this is what the price of ebooks needs to be, because it meant that if that got into the minds of the consumers, that people would expect all electronic books from that point forward to cost that much.
Right.
You know, so
it's reasonable.
Right, right. It's like just like if you were to get something for free for several years and then find out that you have to pay for it, there's going to be that reaction of, wait, what? Just last week I got this for free. Why are you making me pay for it now? Same sort of thing. It's like, wait, what? I just bought that book for $10 last week. Why are you asking for $16 now?
I'm sorry. I was seeing pictures of the New York Times in my head.
Yeah. So what Amazon was doing was actually pretty interesting. It was kind of, Amazon does some pretty risky moves. And what Amazon was doing was the company was buying books just like any other bookstore. Like even digital copies, it was buying digital copies of books, just like any other bookstore,
mm-hmm.
paying the wholesale amount to the publisher. And then that wholesale amount might actually be more than $9.99, but Amazon would just turn around and sell it for $9.99, meaning that they're taking a loss on the sale.
Yep.
But they're doing it in order to build up that market share to attract consumers to using the Kindle platform and purchasing books through the Amazon electronic bookstore. And if they could hook enough people doing that, and they do it by selling books cheaper than any other vendor is going to sell it, because most other vendors can't afford to cut the price that much and take a loss in every single unit sold.
Right.
Amazon can. But the idea was that maybe Amazon could eventually get what effectively would amount to a monopoly on the electronic books market.
Mm-hmm.
And, the publishers did not like this at all. And in fact, we really saw this come to a head when Steve Jobs announced the iPad and iBooks.
Yes.
Because then you saw 5 out of the 6 major publishers sign on immediately with Apple to provide books to the iBooks library. And the price was no longer limited to $9.99. However, Steve Jobs was very firm in that it would not go over, I think it was $14.99 per book.
Yeah. It's a different pricing model, and the publishers are getting a bigger cut.
Right. And there's an agency fee that Apple gets out of it.
Yes. Mm-hmm. About 30%, actually. The thing is with all of this that you may be saying, well, you know, so what is all this price? It goes to all those people we were talking about before, the editors, the publicists. There's not the cost of printing or distribution. This completely falls under, and it's, you know, we use this a lot, the long tail that Chris Anderson talked about, because ebooks never have to go out of print.
Yeah.
They can be there, you know, taking up whatever space they're taking up on the hard drive forever.
Right, it's brilliant. Yeah, as long as you have a good program that can take a master copy and create a user copy from that master copy that makes that user copy unique in some way, because almost every single form of ebook file format that the major publishers want to use will have some form of DRM on it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
To try and prevent piracy.
Yes. As a matter of fact, when the book sale goes through, there's a little bit of metadata that's encoded in that file that keys it to you. So, you know, that's how people know on some digital files that they have been corrupted, is because that information is still embedded in there some way. And they've been cracked, and it is possible. But, you know, that's how, if you open a book on your e-reader, we were talking about the different readers. We didn't talk about the Nook.
Right.
That was one of the features of the Nook, was you're able to lend a book to a friend with another Nook. So the DRM says, well, hey, this is Jonathan's file. And Jonathan, you know, allows me to read it, and I get the 3 weeks, I believe it is, on the Nook.
Was it? I thought it was 2.
It may be 2. Well, however long it is.
Yeah, it's authorized for a specific set period. And after that period, the book is no longer available on the other device. And also, I think during that time, the owner of the book cannot read the book.
That's correct.
Right? Right. So it's almost like it's a physical book in the sense that if I lent Chris a physical copy of a book I have, I could not read that physical copy unless I came over to Chris's house and stood behind him and looked over his shoulder. And trust me, he hates that. So never again.
Knock. Yeah. Is all I'm saying.
You get stabbed in the thigh once with a fork and you do not need to tell me twice, mister. So,
but yeah, that's all done through DRM.
Yeah.
And so, you know, there are costs associated with doing this. And,
yep.
You know,
sure.
That's why they're trying to recoup those costs. They're trying to make a profit because a lot of these are public companies.
And also their business was built around a different model, and to completely shift everything over, you could argue that the electronic model is much more efficient and therefore your costs would decrease dramatically. And therefore you would be able to make, as good or better a profit, even if you cut your prices, just because your costs are lower. But you have to remember, you're talking about revolutionizing an entire industry, which is not something that's simple to do. And also, there is still a demand for printed books. There's not like that. It's not like the demand for printed books has completely vanished.
No.
It's so you have to balance that out. Like, how much focus do you put towards your electronic publishing arm of your company versus your physical publishing?
Mm-hmm.
But also, just to get back to Amazon for a second, another reason why publishers get really scared about Amazon is that Amazon has the potential to become a publisher.
Mm-hmm.
In that there is very little stopping Amazon. In fact, Amazon's been talking about doing this, from having courting writers to write directly for Amazon. So a writer writes a book, and then Amazon acts as both the publisher and the vendor. This could theoretically be a very beneficial relationship for the author, because mm-hmm. authors, if you take the advance out, like let's say that this would really change publishing.
Mm-hmm.
The advance is the big deal for authors right now. And if you are just starting out, that advance is your lifeblood, because you may not sell enough books to have made that much money otherwise. Now, with Amazon's model, you may not get an advance. Instead, Amazon's model might be you will get a 70% cut of every book we sell. So you'll make more money per book sold through Amazon, but you might not make more money total, because the advance you would have received from a traditional publisher might have been more money than you would have made through selling books in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
So this is like a weird gamble here. And publishers are worried that perhaps authors would think that they're going to have a much more beneficial relationship through Amazon, so they're going to go there. They're scared about that. They're scared that that Amazon will be able to undercut all the other sales of books, so that'll hurt sales even more. But the publishers will also counter with saying Amazon doesn't really know how to work with authors.
Mm-hmm.
Like the relationship between authors and publishers is different than between authors and a direct, like a vendor.
Right.
And that Amazon isn't the kind of company that can take time to talk to a new author and kind of discuss with the new author things and to adjust deadlines. That was a big thing, because mm-hmm. writers sometimes don't make deadlines. Mr. Editor. And so
I've been meaning to talk to you about that.
Yeah, I know. I'm a little behind. But the
no, you're a big behind.
Yeah, I know that too. Well, I like big butts and I cannot lie. The Amazon may not be able to take that time and effort to speak with an author the way a publisher could. So there are a lot of trade-offs that we're talking about here. And where this is going to go is anyone's guess. Although, based upon the trends, I would say electronic publishing is just going to continue to become increasingly important. So we may see more authors move to using a platform like Amazon as their publisher. This also pulls into question things like monopolies. Like, would Amazon's writers, would their works be sold on any other, like through any other bookseller, or would they just be available through Amazon?
Do not pass go. Do not collect $200.
Yeah, this gets really complex. And honestly, we don't have all the answers yet.
And speaking of complex and monopolies, it probably is worthwhile to mention some of the controversies that have gone on around the e-publishing model, including the recent, as of the time of recording this in mid-August 2011, Apple telling Barnes & Noble and Amazon that if they wanted to continue to sell books through their apps for the iPad, that they were going to have to fork over some money. So they...
Yeah, 30% cut.
Yep. So just they...
Which is standard across all Apple... Like, that's Apple's standard operating procedure, is that any app that sells something to the end user, Apple gives a 30% cut of that.
Yeah, an in-app purchase.
Yep.
Both of them pulled their sales link out. And of course, you could still buy a book directly from them and then upload it to your iPad if you want to do that. But
even that is a little complicated, I think, because I think there was a discussion about Apple saying that you could only upload titles from a Kindle app that you could also get through Apple Store.
Yeah, it's interesting.
Yeah.
And then they Amazon countered with their Cloud Reader application,
right,
which is an HTML5 reader that allows you to – it's not actually an app. It's actually a site that allows you to read your Amazon books without – going directly through Apple and the Kindle app. So,
yeah.
And everybody's been crowing about that in the last few days as of the time we're recording this. So,
right.
And I have to say it was a pretty clever move around that. Another, big, controversy has been around libraries,
mm-hmm,
who work with a service called Overdrive, which for a long time was an audiobook service for libraries, public libraries to, for people to, listen to stuff, and basically you download the book through a little app, and then you could listen to it. And this, at the end of the checkout period, the DRM in it would shut it out so that you can't use it again.
Mm-hmm.
And they began offering ebooks. Some libraries, like the library that I belong to, has Overdrive's audiobooks, but does not yet have the ebook capabilities, but I've seen it in action. It's pretty cool.
Mm.
Thing is, one of the major publishers, HarperCollins, said that they wanted to limit the number of checkouts that you could use with an ebook to 26. And this caused a lot of library people to be very upset because, again, there's no wear and tear on an ebook.
Yeah.
But HarperCollins' point is, okay, but once a paper book has a certain number of checkouts, let's say about, 26 or so, the book is frayed, the binding is bad, it's been beaten up, it's been left in someone's car, your kid spilled chocolate milk on it, it needs to be replaced. With an ebook, we're not selling more than one copy to you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that one copy can be checked out indefinitely.
Yeah.
So, a lot of people have been very upset about this. The thing is, I could see both sides. Once you bought a copy, hey, you bought a copy. You should be able to check this out as many times as you want to because it's digital and it doesn't wear out.
Yeah.
At the same time, the publisher is not making anything past the original sale, and a library would probably need to replace that copy, especially if it's a popular book.
So I could see.
So what do you do?
Yeah, I could see a consumer saying, if this were the case with a consumer, I could say the consumer saying, hey, what if I take really good care of my books and I never need to replace them anyway? Then you're telling me I'm being punished for using the electronic format. There's also the concept of windowing, where a publisher will publish the hard copy of a book months ahead of any electronic publishing. And usually this is done for two reasons. Well, three, really. One is that electronic books don't count toward bestseller lists.
It depends. Now, New York Times does have an ebook bestseller list, and they have a combined print and ebook bestseller list.
Yeah.
But not all of them do.
Right. There are a lot
That's a recent thing.
Yeah. There are a lot of bestseller lists that would only factor in hard copy sales.
Yeah.
Which means that, publishers who count on bestseller lists as being a marketing ploy, they would not want to hurt the chances of a book getting on that bestseller list by also offering electronic copy, and then people buy the electronic copy but don't buy the hard copy, and then the book doesn't get on the list. Another was that they just were worried about cannibalizing the hardcover sales anyway, because the hardcovers tend to cost more than the electronic ones.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's also the worry about piracy. Although, we have seen with books that have either delayed electronic publication or not had any electronic publication at all show up as pirated electronic copies on various peer-to-peer networks from people who have scanned the books in.
The flip side of that being people like Cory Doctorow, who have offered their ebook version of their book immediately for free.
Yep.
And I think Neil Gaiman has also done that.
I know that there are several authors who have arranged it so that their books will publish in all formats simultaneously.
And the thing is, when they've done a trial like that, a lot of publishers have found that the ebook will actually spur sales of the print book.
Yeah.
And I have done that. I have downloaded the free ebook and I've started reading it. And I said, well, you know what? This was before I had an iPad. So I was reading it on a computer and I thought, you know what? I'm enjoying the first few pages of this book. I'm going to go buy the print book. And I've done that two or three times.
Yeah. Well, there's some things that are still easier to do with print books than with electronic copies. I mean, it's just, you know, that tactile experience, being able to put, markers in your book. I mean, you can do that with a lot of the various electronic formats too, but it's still, there's something psychologically that's just not the same with that. At any rate, The whole system of publication is kind of in this turmoil right now. And we really don't know how it's all going to shake out. We've got a lot of stubborn players with lots of clout out there. So it'll really depend on who shouts the loudest and shakes their fist the hardest and who has the most leverage. And, hopefully whatever happens will end up being good for authors and consumers.
Yeah,
and also for Chris's benefit, editors.
Well, I have to say, I think the publishing industry has been a lot quicker to embrace e-technology than the recording or the movie industry has.
Definitely either of those two, yes.
And they've done so well. I think in general, everybody, the publishers and the technology providers and the readers, have all made advances in working together to make this happen. There's just a lot of issues that have to be worked out so that everybody is able to coexist peacefully.
Yeah, I have
or relatively peacefully.
I would imagine that one of the developments we will eventually see will have to be some sort of antitrust charges against Amazon, because even though there are other players in the electronic books market, I think Amazon's domination is hard to argue. I know that iBooks, when it first launched, had a really positive launch, had a lot of interest in it. But from what I understand, the iBooks sales are not comparable to Kindle sales. And I think part of that is, again, what we mentioned earlier in the podcast, which is the Kindle app just provides for a lot of flexibility, since you can read it on various devices. Mm-hmm. And whereas the iBooks app is a little more limited, and it works great if you have a lot of iOS devices, but if you've got other ones that you would like to read stuff on, that's kind of, you're out of luck if you're using iBooks.
Yeah.
Anyway, the situation is changing dramatically and quickly, especially for, industry like publication, which remained unchanged for decades. It was definitely one of those legacy type industries that, you know, the longer you stay the way you are, the harder it's going to be when changes come. Mm-hmm. So it's actually kind of surprising to see how fast things are changing right now. We'll keep an eye on it, and we'll probably do another podcast in the future once things kind of, shake out a little bit more, to see sort of the pathway that we took and why people chose the different ways to get to where we go. It'll be exciting. I can't wait to find out what I'm reading next. Anyway, we're going to wrap up this episode of Tech Stuff. We've got another one we have to cram in here in the studio before we get kicked out. So what I'd like to do is to invite all of our listeners to submit their ideas for topics that we should tackle in the future. You can let us know in email. Our email address is techstuff@howstuffworks.com, or you can contact us through Facebook or Twitter. Our handle there is TechStuffHSW. Chris and I will talk to you again really soon.
Be sure to check out our new video podcast, Stuff from the Future. Join HowStuffWorks staff as we explore the most promising and perplexing possibilities of tomorrow. The HowStuffWorks iPhone app has arrived. Download it today on iTunes. Brought to you by the reinvented 2012 Camry. It's ready. Are you?
Running a business is no cakewalk, but with SAP Concur Solutions, you can be ready for anything. You can manage travel, expenses, and AP all on one platform that's packed with AI and best practices, and that delivers it all through an easy, clear, I can't believe how simple that is experience. So, while not much can be done about that guy who never fails to burn the microwave popcorn and stink up the entire office, with SAP Concur, you can easily handle almost anything else. Take control of your business finances today at concur.com. That's concur.com.
It's brand new season two. I'm Marissa Thalberg.
And I'm Stephen Wolf at Adam. And we're excited to be back having bigger, bolder, and always real conversations.
Straight from the C-suite front lines of marketing, media, and more.
We have great friends joining from people you may know, like Vilmer Valderrama and Bobby Burke.
And people you'll want to know. So grab a coffee or, hey, even an Aperol Spritz and come join us on America's number one podcast network, iHeart.
Listen to brand new on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, acclaimed comics writer and notorious Scott Summers hater, Rosie Knight.
Well, hello, Emmy-winning podcaster and totally unbiased Targaryen royal supporter, Jason Concepcion.
Somehow the X-Ray Vision podcast has returned.
And like always, we'll be here every week.
You'll hear from TV writers, actors, comics creators, pop culture critics.
Nothing is off the table.
Listen to X-Ray Vision on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Get emotional with me, Radhi Devlukia, in my new podcast, A Really Good Cry. We're going to be talking with some of my best friends.
I didn't know we were going to go there on this.
People that I admire.
When we say listen to your body, really tune in to what's going on.
Authors of books that have changed my life.
Now you're talking about sympathy, which is different than empathy, right?
Never forget, it's okay to cry as long as you make it a really good one. Listen to A Really Good Cry with Radhi Devlukia on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.